My first encounter with Mrs. Charlotte Despard was at the age of 18 months. Being a motherless child and my father being an officer in the army under her brother, the then General French, later becoming Earl of Ypres, was posted abroad, so was unable to care for me. I was made a ward of Chancery in the High Courts. Owing to a dispute with his family and my mother's relations, he was unable to look after to run a staple home for me. Mrs. Despard therefore was made my guardian until the age of 21. She had married a rich banker and tea planter and was widowed in 1890. This put her in a good position to carry out her long for wish to help with the pioneering of the working class, instead of setting about and having a quiet, peaceful, ladylike way, as she could have done easily. She was a Lady Despard in her own right, her husband having a title. He had left her plenty of money and 12 servants, or maids, as she always said, no one is a servant to another. She would always ask her staff, male or female, would you please do so and so, and taught me to treat them as one of us. And she got far more respect from them. The first home I can remember was our flat at 2 Curry Street, 9 Elms Lane, Battersea. Here, Archie, as I called Mrs. D, well, I should say that, should I? I couldn't say Auntie, had a Welsh family working for her. The mother was the cook. The eldest daughter, Edie, parlour maid, became nursemaid when my nanny was not there to look after me, as she was the well-known Miss Mansell, who was at Archie's side and did all her arrangements, housekeeping, secretary, also running her clinic, as she was a trained nurse. This flat we lived in was over two small cottages, one being a shop with glass around one side, which when the walls were knocked down, making a nice long hall. Mrs. Despard used this hall under our flat to run a boys' club, girls' club, mother's meeting, and at one end she had a large cupboard and sink to run a clinic every morning. The other end was used on Sundays as a Roman Catholic chapel. The priest coming from the Roman Catholic Church, the other end of 9 Elms Lane, near the famous dog's home. She also had a soup kitchen every morning. Children could get a dinner for a penny. They paid a halfpenny for a hot bowl of soup and a halfpenny for a savoury or pudding. There was a council infant school in Ponting Road, just round the corner, and the headmistress was a Miss Cole Cox, who was very keen on Mrs. Despard's work and helped her to get rid of the terrible steep steps with iron tips that the children had to climb up to their desks, which were built in those days in tiers from the floor. Don't I remember them?
Yeah.
In the first class were the youngest babies. She had little wooden tables and chairs instead of desks, and had some canvas with rings on the corners, fixed to the legs. When the tables were turned upside down, to make little hammocks for the children to rest in after their dinner midday, which she had the council arranged to send to the school. That was one of the first school dinners.
Well, that's all before the state gets round to it, isn't it?
Oh, yes. This little collection of streets around her house was called the Island, as it had a cluster of short streets which could only be reached from the main Nine Elms Lane from two roads, Ponting Road and Everett Street. She made this house her home for 36 years, so as to help to improve the lives of the workers and their families in the island. The island was surrounded by the railway's good yard on one side, the gas works on the other, and in the winter at Christmas, she would arrange for 100 weight of coal to be delivered to the old folk from the gasworks, free. In about 1925, she gave the house over to the council to carry on her work, as she wanted to live in Ireland to help the unemployed during the Depression over there. She took a house in Dublin. The council, meanwhile, put a Miss Cole in charge of the arranged to have a babysitting settlement in our flat above the club room. Here babies from the few months came if unable to be looked after at home. Mrs. Despard still had control for a while and would come back to England to see how it was going on. I remember...
You read that page, haven't you, I think? Because you read the front part.
Mm-hmm. I think this is going to be a muddle.
No, that's fine so far.
I remember on one occasion I went with her to see how they had decorated the room to be made into a day nursery. I admired the nursery rhymes on the wallpaper, but she took one look at it and said to the builder, "Take all that off. I don't want the children to see those terrible rhymes. They are all cruel and teach cruelty and horror and fear." So it all had to be altered. In 1929, the house was called Despard House. It was dedicated to her for the many years of work she had done there by unveiling a tablet in the inside wall between the two front doors. This was only one side of her work that I came up against while with her.
I help that now while you... Yes. What did... she went off on a coal van, didn't she?
No, she used to go for speeches out in the open for the workers and the suffragettes at various times, but usually for the workers in Hyde Park in Speaker's Corner. And she'd sit on a... I don't know how she went, but we used to go in a procession with the banners and all that, especially when there was coal strikes or anything like that. And they decorate the coal carts from Nine Elms and different things, depots, and we'd all stand in it and go all the way through the streets from Battersea, right the way up to London. And then while she spoke, she'd get on one of these carts and speak from there. And I'd be standing there beside her. And the last time I remember her coming over, I think she was 80-something, 86 or so, she spoke on Trafalgar Square. It's her last meeting in England, open-air meeting. And I used to have a paper cutting of it, but I've lost that. And I'm sitting there, you can just sort of see part of me, you don't see who it is, but there's a hand holding her up because she had a very bad back. She'd had a fall in Ireland. And I'm holding her up, and there she is talking like that at 86, I think it was.
Was she a good speaker, actually?
Very, yes. Oh, yes, she could. Her voice would carry a long way, even out in the open, you know.
But did she use her arms, and was she very...
No. She stressed, usually went like that, fight with me, or come, listen to what I'm saying. That was all. She never did a lot of this. It was all that. All that. It's very...
Did she sort of vary the tones of her voice? Was she quiet and loud and high pitch and low pitch? You know,
she would go high at times if she wanted to stress a point. Mm. But she wasn't one to shout. No, her voice went naturally and it...
Mm. What about if she was interrupted? And did she, was she good with interruptions?
Oh, if anyone interrupted her, she'd say, just a minute. And then she'd go on with her, now what was it you wanted, she'd say, quite calmly. And they'll say, yes, now you're right there, I'll explain. And she'll explain to them, she
said. She's quite good with
it. Oh, yes, she was never lost her temper, never got flustered or anything. Yes. And if there was a riot, all right, friends, everybody was friends, all right, friends. Mm. Calm friends.
Did she always wear her mantilla then when she was speaking?
Mm. right from the time she came back from India with her husband, you see.
Did she really? Yeah.
She took so much to their, same with her sandals. Mm. Yes, that's a bit out there. She had a country house in Oxford, Surrey. That's my second home.
She had two houses, didn't she? When she was one was in Battersea and one was in Oxford.
Yes, in Oxford. In Oxford. That was the first country house I have. Mm. And she, when she went to India, she saw the Indians with the Indian women with their lovely sandals and that, so she took to the sandals. When she came back to England, she refused to wear our shoes. She said, no, sandals. Well, the Indians, someone in India, used to make them for her and send them. Mm. But of course, it was a long, long time before they got there. And then when she wore them out, or perhaps the person who made them died or something, they ceased being done. So while she was at Oxford, because I don't remember that, but somebody told me that they ceased coming from India. So I remember him, because I saw him years after. We went there as a picnic, Auntie, Granny and I, as I called her afterwards. And I think it was Miss Cole or Miss Reeves or somebody went with us to a picnic for the day from London and sat on the sands, and we looked over the gate at the old house. And then while we were sitting there, a gentleman came along and he was sort of in... listening to us and looking at us, not coming near, but sort of just looking and smiling. And then he gradually had the strength to come a little nearer, and I turned round and said, okay, I said, I think there's someone here wishes to speak to you. And then he came forward, he said, Mrs. Despard, and I said, yes. He said, you don't know me? And she said, I seem to know your face. She said, dear, I don't know you, I know so many. He said, Mr. Penfold. And that was the cobbler that used to be in Oxshott, that made her sandals for her. And he made his own design. Mm. And I've never seen one since. Oh. It was plaited, there were thin straps of leather, plaited in the middle here, and went down like that with a plait in the middle. One piece that shape from the toe, and then a piece round here of the leather. But it was so pretty.
And she always wore those, nothing
always
else.
Always wore those, yes. Never known her wearing shoes all my life.
Did she have any other oddities about her clothing, apart from the mantilla and the...
No, very full dresses, like that, and very low, like the Indians had, you know. But they weren't, it wasn't a siara like the Indians do. It didn't have it all gathered like that, you know.
No. Was she fussy about her dress, do you think, her appearance? I mean, did she take a lot of trouble about it, or...?
I don't think so, because her maid used to do it for her. Her hair she was rather particular about, and I remember when she used to go to the hairdresser, that was a thing, she would always go to one hairdresser, and I said, well, why would you always go there, dear? She said, because that's where I started having women. And she said, the gentleman there knows. And she said, I have converted him, and he knows that the women have got to do the women's side of the hairdressing. Because you used to be always men, you see.
Yes, I see. Yes.
And this one lady used to do her hair up, because she was like me, she's got very fine hair. I've got very fine hair. And this part up here, you see, went flat like mine does. So she used to have pads under there, in those days, you see, they got both pads. And then she had high up, and then the mantilla went down nicely then.
Was she a tall woman, actually, or made her taller, really?
No, I don't think she was any taller than me, but she had that appearance of tallness.
Yes. You
know? And of course the mantilla, and that made her look taller.
And she presumably walked in a dignified way.
Oh yes, always right, and very slow. And
that's interesting. interesting, yes.
Because out the east they walk so much slower. She learnt that all out there.
That brings me to theosophy. Did she try and influence you with theosophy?
Not very much, I don't think. You see, she didn't try and influence me with religion either. Because she always said, I'm not going to influence you. I'll take you around to all the different religions there are. I mean, about five. Because she said, I don't want your family, your relations, to tell me that I have persuaded you into my church, you see. She didn't want any, there was such a quarrel between my father and his brothers over property in Africa, and then my aunts over who should look after me. She didn't want to make any more quarrels, you know.
I see, yes. So, you can be a Catholic and a theosophist, can't you? You don't have to give up the one to be the other, do you? It's a sort of on top of...
I don't think so, they have got a creed, because I used to go to a convalescent home, a philosopher's convalescent home at Brighton, and they had their own chapel, you know, and way of doing it.
But as you said, she had the priest along.
Oh yes, the Catholic she kept priest. Her Catholics, yes, yeah. She kept... But she was as the church I didn't finish telling you about the Catholic Church, I went there. And they said, oh, well, of course, she wasn't in the soul and body, which means that she wouldn't accept the confessions, see?
Yes.
And so one of the fathers, and he knew I was a Catholic, you see, when at the end of the Mass, I said, well, at the end of one of the Masses, I said to him, he stood at the door saying, you know, goodbye, goodbye to everybody, and I went to him, and I said, oh, Miss Father, so-and-so, I forget his name, I said, could we have a service, a Mass for her memory, as these women want it? Oh, he said, you know, she wasn't in the... Come and see me round my city. So I went round there on a special day. No, that day he said to me, he said, of course, she wasn't in the soul and body of the church room, that sort of thing. So I said, oh, all right. He said, I'll do an ordinary Mass. I said, oh, well, I can do that any time, see. He said, oh, yes, I'll mention her in a Mass. I said, oh, all right. So I went back to this collector and I said, now gather all the people into your cottage. And I came in and I said, well, that's the results. And I told them each church had said... And I said, her own church said that she wasn't in the soul and body. So Mrs. Slater, who was a Catholic, says, see? So she said, you wait till next Sunday, Miss. She says, I'm going to see him. So she went to Mass just the same, and he was at the door. So she shook hands, and she said, I hear that Miss Holmes has been to see you about the memorial service. And... So he said, oh, yes, I know, I did say she could have a Mass. So she said, yes, but what's that? She said, oh, we want a special services. We've collected a lot of money for it. See? So I immediately got a letter. I showed it to them after. Oh, Miss Foley, you didn't mention that there had been a collection for it. See, they were ready to do it then.
Yeah.
So I said, well, am I to accept it? So they all said no. They were, you know, all working people, but they weren't going to be treated as dirt.
How did she get on with the local working people in Battersea? She was very popular, wasn't she?
Oh, they worshipped her. Mm. Oh, they worshipped her. Do you know, she even had she had to have a car at times to get from one place to the other, but she even had an electric car, one of the first electric cars in, so that they couldn't go quickly round the bend there, round... She said, this is a children's playground, go slowly, she'd tell the driver. They used to all play in the streets, so they've got nowhere else to go. Little backyards.
So she was real friends with local people?
She loved them. They loved her, yes. Or they worshipped her.
Because she did so much for them, of course, didn't she? But also, I suppose, because she was very approachable, was she? I mean,
she was. They could come to her for anything. She had a basket in the red on that, a basket for maternity cases. And we had a bell up high so the children couldn't get it. They used to love bringing the bell and running away. But this was very high up. And anyone could ring up that in the middle of the night or anything. Edie Davis, she knew that if that bell rang, it was for the basket. And that basket full of all the maternity clothes was sent out. No questions asked. Mrs. So-and-so was expecting a baby. Off it would go.
But did Mrs. Despard live there all the week then, and then go to Oxshott at the weekends usually, or
what? Well, she didn't go to the Oxshott very often, she wanted a holiday and wanted to do some writing, because she used to write a lot, you see.
I see, yes.
She would be there in the winter. She was up here in the winter.
You mean in Oxshott? in the winter?
No, up in London. She took down to Oxford in the summer, you see.
I see, yes, yes, yes.
That house is still standing. In fact, I was, how old was I, a few years ago, was nursing near there, and I went into Oxshott and I looked over the gate and saw the very same tree that I had a photo of me in long clothes on her arms, and all the old Battersea people that had come for the day in the break, she'd have a break for them to come down, sitting round, and their big hats and everything, you know, it's amazing. And I was looking over there, and suddenly a gentleman came along. He says, "Oh, do you want anything?" I said, "So rude." I said, "I beg your pardon." I said, "I'm looking there because I said I was here years ago," and I explained who I was. "Oh, come in," she said. "My wife would love to see you," and she apparently knew Auntie, you see.
Yeah, yeah.
So I said who I was, and they invited me into tea and showed me, and they kept the appearance of the house, but they had built on and altered it. Done it beautifully, you know.
What was it like inside? Was it comfortable inside this house?
Oh yes, it was a real Elizabethan house, and we had a great big fireplace that you could sit in the seats aside.
Oh yes.
And
yes.
Once she had a time when she wouldn't pay any taxes, you know, she said, that's what you've heard about that.
Yes.
So we hid in this fireplace with the curtains drawn, and I kept peeping through. I'm seeing these men looking in the window, saying there was anyone there, and maids used to sit all up the stairs and kept looking over the window like that and ducking down.
She barred the door, did she? She locked the house?
Oh, she locked, yes. Then we had another house, only she shared another house later on with a Mrs. Harvey, and she had a great big wood, and there was five gates to it, and all five of these gates were padlocked. They could climb over, of course, but they weren't allowed to come over like that. That was the law, you see.
Yes.
You could come in, open a gate, but if the gate was locked, you couldn't climb over it. I don't know, I'm scared of that.
Did she like her comforts? I mean, was she good in the house at all, or?
Oh yeah, she liked things, but she wasn't, she liked things, and she was pretty modernised, you know. I mean, when electricity came in, she had gas came in, she had a gas stove instead of a coal stove, and all that sort of thing. But she wasn't fussy.
No, she didn't do it herself anyway.
Oh, no, staff, you always had a steward of some sort, you know, a gentleman, somebody used to do it.
Mm. And when you first knew her, she had 12 servants, did you say? And then it went down to much
less. Well, she'd had all that number in India, you just sort of clapped her hand and that sort of thing, but she liked it, but it was the only thing to do out there, you see. I mean, her husband's position she's got to think of, but she didn't like it at all. So that really, I think some of them were dark, and I think they were the ones that she brought over with her, you see. And then, of course, she gradually took on these Davises. Well, there was five of them. There was the mother, father, and three daughters.
They were Battersea people, were they?
Well, they lived in Battersea, but they were really Welsh. They'd come from Wales. But they'd got a little cottage just down Everett Street, you see. And that was the funny part. When I had this aunt come for me, or get someone, they'd slip me out of one door, you see, and rush down to Edie's house. I'd be there. It was most peculiar.
But she always called her maids by their Christian name, didn't
yes,
she?
Yes, it was Edie, Ethel.
Yes.
Forget who the other ones were.
But they call her madam, would they? And she'd call
them... They used to like to call her like that, you see, and...
But she always would say, what, please...
Please may I have so-and-so, or Edie, have you got time to do so-and-so for me, you know?
And she really believed in talking to them like that.
Yes,
yes, that's very interesting.
Well, you know, she never would order anything. And if I'd say to her, like I did when I went to Dublin and saw them, they were doing her, because she went over to Dublin, I haven't come to that part yet, they came over to Dublin and she took a house and she turned it into a jam factory. That was when the Irish Depression was going on. And I went over there because I'd had a slight accident doing a silly thing. I was putting an old broom head on a new pole, and I went like this with a step below, like this, pressing it down, and it snapped, and the nail caught me just there and set me up rather a goiter or something. And Dr. Knight came to the rescue, and she got it down, and then she sent me to her Brighton convalescent home. You know, she's got one there, she has, at Brighton. And then from there I went over to Ireland, because Auntie was over here, or Granny as I called her then, was over here, and she said, well, I'm going back. She said, well, I'm glad you're better, I'm going back. But she said to Dr. Knight, do you think she could come with me? Oh, she said, that'd be lovely. She could do with the rest, you see. So I went over. And I say they raided her house. And during the Black and Tan time, you see. And she had this jam patch. I'd heard about it, and of course I went to see it. And they got one room and office in there. And Madame Gong McBride.
Oh, yes.
She was a well-known one because she was a great revolutionist. She got, her house was burnt to the ground or something. She lost all her property because her husband was supposed to have killed the mayor of Cork. He was executed. Mm. McBride was executed. And so she and her son fled and they came to Auntie somehow or other. Half her furniture was brought to Auntie's. And then they got in partnership, got friendly and that, in partnership and started this jam factory for their workers.
I see, yes. What about practical things? Was she a practical woman, Mrs. Despard? I mean, was she, I mean, what about money and things like that? I mean.
Oh, yes, I think, I don't know. I think Miss Mansell used to see to all that for her, my
Did
nanny.
She? Yes.
She was her organiser and.
Was she? She was a suffragette, wasn't she, Miss Mansell?
Well, yes and no. She hadn't really much time to do much, but she used to always go with her. She knew a lot about it.
Mm.
I don't know whether she was. She might have been.
Of course, you weren't. You wouldn't remember things from the suffragette
days. No, because I was only a child.